stretched its way out of the poor bastard's back. Helen Justineau stares down at it, all sick and sombre. Gallagher guesses she's thinking about the little hungry kid. Like a mother before the breakdown, thinking the world's a big place and there's lots of sick people in it, and where's my baby girl? Yeah, full of sick people, the world. He's related to a whole lot of them. And he met a whole lot more when the base fell. And part of his unease right now, maybe the biggest part, comes from the feeling that he's not moving in a direction that makes any sense. Sure, he's going home. But that's like putting your foot back in a trap after you've somehow got free of it. They can't go back to the base, obviously. There isn't any base, not any more, and the bastards who tore it down might still be chasing them. But Gallagher can't see Beacon as a refuge. He can only see it as a mouth opening in front of him to swallow him down. He tries to shake off the mood of despair. He tries to look and feel like a soldier. He wants Helen Justineau to be reassured by his presence. They've been working their way down a long road with shops on both sides, but the shops have all been ransacked long ago. They're way too obvious. Easy targets for anyone who came this way. Probably most of them got looted during the early days of the breakdown. So now they turn their attention to the houses in the side streets, which are harder to get into and harder to search. You have to do a recce for hungries, first of all, and you have to make as little noise as you can breaking in, because obviously noise is going to bring them if there are any of them around. Then once inside, you have to do another recce. Could be a whole nest of hungries in any of these houses, former residents or uninvited guests. It's slow going, and it preys on your nerves. And it's depressing, because the rain has set in solidly now. They're getting pissed on out of a grim grey sky. And last of all, it's boring. If something can be both really scary and boring at the same time. The houses all seem the same to Gallagher. Dark, musty smelling with squishy carpets underfoot, mouldering curtains and sprays of black mildew up interior walls. Cluttered up with millions of things that don't do anything except get in your way and almost trip you over. It's like before the breakdown, people used to spend their whole lives making cocoons for themselves out of furniture and ornaments and books and toys and pictures and any kind of shit they could find. As though they hoped they'd be born out of the cocoon as something else. Which some of them were, of course, but not in the way they'd hoped. In most of the houses, Justineau and Gallagher stay just long enough to check the kitchen. In some, there's a utility room or a garage that they check too. They stay resolutely away from the fridges and freezers, which they know will be filled with a riot of stinking, festering shit. It's canned goods and packet goods that are the jackpot here. But they don't find any. The kitchens are bare. They move on to the next street with similar results. At the very end of it, there's a lock-up garage with a bright green door, which they almost walk past. But it's right next to a looted corner shop, and Justineau slows to a halt. "You thinking what I'm thinking?" she asks Gallagher. He wasn't thinking anything until she said it, but he thinks fast now, so he has something to say besides, "Huh?" "The lock-up might belong to the shop," he guesses. "Damn straight. It doesn't look like anyone's been in there. Let's take a look private." They try the garage door, which is locked. It's made of some light, thin metal, which is good in one way. It's not going to be hard to break it down. And bad in another. Anything they do to it is going to make a hell of a lot of noise. Gallagher gets his bayonet wedged in under one corner of the door and pulls it back. With a loud, shrill squeal, the metal folds. When it's far enough away from the frame, they get their fingers around the edge of it and pull, slowly and steadily. It's still making that same grinding noise, but there's nothing they can do about that. They bend back a triangular flap about 3 feet on its longest side. They look in all directions and listen, tense as hell. No sign or sound of anything coming, from either end of the street. They go down on hands and knees and crawl inside. Gallagher clicks his torch on and plays it around. The garage is full of boxes. Most of them are empty. Out of the ones that have stuff in them, most turn out not to be food, but papers and magazines, kids' toys, stationery. The rest? Well, there is food, but it's snack food, mostly. Packets of crisps, peanuts, pork scratchings, chocolate bars and biscuits, boiled sweets in tubes about the length of a rifle bullet, individually wrapped Swiss rolls, and bottles. All kinds of bottles. Lemonade and orangeade and limeade, cola and blackcurrant juice and ginger beer. Not water, but pretty much everything else you could imagine, as long as your imagination restricts itself to saccharin and carbon dioxide. "You think any of this is still good?" Gallagher whispers.
"Only one way to find out,"
Justin whispers back. They carry out a blind taste challenge, ripping open plastic packets and nibbling cautiously on what's inside. The crisps are foul, soft and crumbly, with a sour, sweaty tang to them. They spit them out hastily. The biscuits are okay, though.
"Hydrogenated oils," Justin says, spraying crumbs. "Probably last until the heat death of the fucking universe."
The peanuts are best of all. Gallagher can't believe their taste, as salty and intense as meat. He eats 3 packets before he can stop himself. When he looks up, Justin is grinning at him. But it's a friendly grin, not a mean one. He laughs out loud, pleased that the two of them have shared this ridiculous feast, and that in the twilight of the garage she can't see him blushing. He shouts out to Sarge on the walkie-talkie and tells him that they're bringing home the bacon, or at least some stuff that's got bacon flavouring in it. Park says to load up and come back in with his heartiest congratulations. They fill up the backpacks and their pockets, and each of them takes a couple of boxes besides. When they emerge cautiously into the street again 10 minutes later, they've still got it to themselves. They head for home in a mood of euphoria. They've done the hunter-gatherer thing, and they've done it well. Now they're bringing the mammoth back to the cave. A campfire will be lit against the dark, and there'll be carousing and stories. Well, maybe not that. But a locked door, a decent meal, and Fleetwood Mac if their luck is in. Chapter 55. Dr. Caldwell unpacks the 6 Tupperware containers containing brain tissue from the male hungry at Wainwright House and lays them side by side on the newly disinfected surface in front of her. The lab workshops are made of a synthetic marble substitute, which mixes marble dust with bauxite and polyester. It's not as cold as real stone. When she momentarily lays her hot, throbbing hands on it, it offers her little relief. She prepares slides from each of the samples. She doesn't call the Atlum into play for this, because Rosie still has no functional power source, and also because the material has been scooped out of the hungry's skull with a spoon. It doesn't lie in its natural layers, and little would be gained by slicing it so very finely. She'll need the Atlum later, but not for these samples. For now, she spreads tiny amounts of the brain tissue across the slides as thinly as she can, adds a single drop of staining agent to each, and drops the covers on with gingerly care. The bandages impede her movements, so this takes longer than it should. 6 tissue samples, 5 available staining agents, which are cerium sulfate, ninhydrin, D282, bromocresol, and P-anisaldehyde. Caldwell has the highest hopes of the D282, a fluorescent lipophilic carbon cyanine with proven efficacy in throwing fine neuron structures into high relief. But she's not going to ignore the other stains, since she has them to hand. Any of them has the potential to yield valuable data. The natural thing to do now would be to power up the transmission electron microscope, which sits in the corner of the lab like the bastard offspring of a road drill and an Imperial stormtrooper from the Star Wars trilogy,
all white ceramic and smooth sculpted curves. But there's that whole absence of power thing again. The microscope is not going to wake up and serve her until Sergeant Parks feeds it. In the meantime, she turns her attention to the sporangium. The lab boasts a number of manipulator tanks, with two circular holes along one side. The holes are sphinctered. Elbow-length rubber gloves can be inserted through them and rendered airtight by a mixture of sealant gel and mechanical adjustments. Once the sporangium is safely sequestered from the rest of the lab inside one of these tanks, Caldwell begins to examine it. She tries to open it with her gloved fingers and fails. Its outer shell is tough and elastic and very thick. Even with a scalpel, it's not easy going. Inside, effortlessly infolded, is a fine, fractal froth of spores, like grey soap bubbles that spills out through the opening she's made. Curious, she dips her finger in. There's no resistance. Even as densely packed together as this, the spores seem to have no mass at all. She becomes aware while she's doing this that she's no longer alone in the lab. Sergeant Parks has entered and is watching her in silence. He has his gun, not the rifle, but his sidearm, in his hand. As casually as such a thing can be carried in a civilized place such as a lab, where it has no conceivable place. Caldwell ignores him for a while as she continues to cut carefully into the grey gourd to examine its interior structure. The good news, she observes, her eyes and her attention staying on the contents of the tank, is that the sporangium's integument appears to be extremely resilient. None of the ones we saw on the ground had broken open, and it's impossible to tear them open with your bare hands. They appear to require an external environmental trigger in order to germinate, and so far that trigger hasn't materialized. Parks doesn't answer. He still hasn't moved. Did you ever consider a scientific career, Sergeant? Caldwell asks him, still with her back to him.
Not really, Parks says.
Good. You're really far too stupid. The sergeant looms at her side. You think I'm missing something? He demands. Caldwell is very conscious of the gun. When she glances down, it's there, directly in her line of sight. The sergeant is holding it in both hands, ready to fire. Yes.
What am I missing?
She puts down the scalpel and withdraws her hands, very slowly, from the gloves and from the tank. Then she turns to look him in the eyes. You see that I'm pale and sweating. You see that my eyes are red. You see that I'm slowing down as I walk.
Yeah, I see that.
And you're ready with your diagnosis.
Doc, I know what I know.
Ah, but you don't, Sergeant. Not really. She's begun to undo the bandages on her left hand. She rolls it up for him to see. As the white linen falls away, her flesh is laid bare. The hand itself is fish-belly white and a little puckered. Red lines begin at the wrist and climb her arm, climb downwards since her hand is raised, but gravity's no guide here. The poison is finding its way to her heart, and it pays no mind to the vagaries of local topography. Blood poisoning, Caldwell says. Severe inflammatory sepsis. The first thing I did when we arrived here was to give myself a massive dose of amoxicillin, but it's almost certainly far too late. I'm not turning into a hungry sergeant. I'm only dying. So please leave me alone to get on with my work. But Park stays where he is for a few minutes longer. Caldwell understands. He's a man with a strong preference for the sorts of problems that have a simple, unitary solution. He thought Caldwell was such a problem, but now he realizes she isn't. It's hard for him to cope with the shift in perspective. She understands, but she really can't help. And she doesn't really care. What matters now is her research, which, after so long a period of stagnation, is finally starting to look promising.
You're saying these fruit things aren't dangerous? He asks her.
Caldwell laughs. She can't help herself.
Not at all, Sergeant,
she assures him.
Unless the prospect of a planet-wide extinction event troubles you.
His face, as open as a book, announces relief, then confusion, finally suspicion.
What?
Caldwell is almost sorry to have to burst the precious bubble of his ignorance. I already told you that the sporangia contain the spores of the hungry pathogen. But you don't seem to have taken in what that means. In its mature, asexual form, Ophiocordyceps toppled our global civilization in the space of 3 years. The only reason it didn't achieve global pandemic status at once, the only reason any pockets of uninfected humans were able to survive, was because the immature organism can only propagate, neotenuously, in biofluid.
Doc, the sergeant says, looking pained, if you're going to talk like a fucking encyclopedia.
Blood and spit, sergeant. It lives in blood and spit. It doesn't like to venture out into the open air, and it doesn't thrive there. But the adult form... She waves a hand over the innocuous white globe nestling at the bottom of the tank. Well, the adult form will take no prisoners. Each sporangium contains, at a rough estimate, from 1 to 10 million spores. They will be airborne and light enough to travel tens or hundreds of miles from their place of origin. If they float into the upper atmosphere, as some of them will, they could easily cross continents. They will be robust enough to survive for weeks, months, perhaps years. And if you breathe them in, you'll be infected. You can see a hungry coming, but you'll have a harder time with an organism less than a millimeter across. A harder time seeing it, and a harder time keeping it out. I estimate that what's left of humanity 1.0 will close up shop within a month of one of these pods opening.
But you said they won't open,
Park says, stricken.
I said they won't open by themselves.
This species is a sport, a mutant form, and its development is haphazard. But sooner or later, the trigger event, whatever it is, will happen. It's only a matter of time, with the probability rising gradually towards 100%. Parks doesn't seem to have anything to say to that. He withdraws at last and leaves her to it. And although she didn't let his presence slow her down too much, she's a lot happier to be alone.
Chapter 56.
Helen Justineau enjoyed the foraging expedition more than she thought she was going to. Found that time spent in the company of Kieran Gallagher was surprisingly bearable. But when they get back to Rosie, with only 10 minutes of daylight to spare, and they find Melanie hasn't returned yet, the worry drops on her like a 10-ton weight in an old Monty Python sketch. Where the hell could she be all this time? How hard would it have been for her to rustle up something to eat? Justineau remembers the fox back in Stevenage. She hadn't seen Melanie catch it, but she'd seen her walking along with the animal squirming in her arms, shifting its weight as it struggled so that she wouldn't lose her balance. If you could catch a fox, then a rat or a stray dog or a cat or a bird ought to be no trouble at all. There's no telling what Melanie might have run into out there. Justineau should have tried to find her, instead of staying with private function and looking for food. She's instantly contrite about that instinctive surge of contempt for Gallagher. His only faults, really, are that he's young, green as grass, and flat-out idolatrous when it comes to Sergeant Parks. Who is somewhat taciturn and withdrawn, Justineau realises now. He took the barest glance at what they'd found, commended them with that instinctive surge of contempt for Gallagher. His only faults, really, are that he's young, green as grass, and flat-out idolatrous when it comes to Sergeant Parks. Who is somewhat taciturn and withdrawn, Justineau realises now. He took the barest glance at what they'd found, commended them with a nod and a grunt, and then went back into the engine room. She follows him there. What do we do if she doesn't come back? She demands. The sergeant has his head down in the guts of the generator, which he's started to dismantle. His voice comes back muffled. What do you think? I'm going to go and look for her, Justineau says. That gets Park's right way up again pretty quick, which is why she said it. She's not seriously contemplating going out into the dark. There'd be no point. She wouldn't be able to use the torch without announcing her presence and location to anyone and everything else on the streets. Without the torch, she'd be blind, and with it only marginally less so. The Hungries would home in on the moving light, or on her scent, or on her body heat, and it would all be over in a minute. So when Parks tells her these things, in slightly cruder and more emphatic terms, she doesn't even bother to listen. She waits him out and then says again, "Then what do we do?"
"There isn't anything we can do," Parks says. "She's a lot safer out there than you or I would be, and she's a smart kid. With the night coming on, she knows enough to go to ground and wait for daylight."
"What if she can't find her way back? What if she gets turned around in the dark or just forgets the way? We have no idea how far she went, and these streets probably all look alike to her. Even in daylight, she might not be able to locate us again."
Parks is looking at her hard.
"I'm not sending up a flare," he says. "If that's what you're thinking about, forget it."
"What do we lose?" Justinu demands. "We're in a frigging tank, Parks. Nothing can touch us."
He throws down the manual he's been clutching all this time and picks up a wrench. For a moment, she thinks he's going to hit her with it. She realises with sharp surprise that he's as tense as she is.
"They wouldn't have to touch us," he points out grimly. "They just have to camp out on the doorstep for a day or so. We're not well placed to stand up to a siege, Helen. Not with salted peanuts and Jaffa cakes."
She knows he's right, as far as that goes. It doesn't matter, since she's already swiped the flare pistol from the mess of stuff Parks dumped on the floor when he gave her the pack. She's tucked it into the back of her jeans, where it barely makes a bulge. So long as she stays out of the light, she's fine. But whatever is eating Parks, it's different from what's eating her. Not knowing makes her uneasy.
"What's the matter?" she demands. "Did something happen while we were out?"
"Nothing happened," Parks says too quickly. "But we've got no E-blockers left and nothing here we can use instead. From now on, any time we step outside, we're leaving a scent trail that leads right back to our front door. And if the kid does come back, we'll need a lot more than a muzzle and a leash to keep her under control. She's going to be smelling us all the time. What do you think that's going to do to her?"
That question winds its way viciously and insinuatingly through Justinu's mind. For a moment, she can't speak. She remembers what the feeding frenzy did to Melanie back at the base. She imagines Melanie losing control like that again, inside Rosie. How will they even let her in to put the muzzle and handcuffs back on her? Knowing Parks the way she does, as a man who sees the angles and dots the I's, she wonders how much of this he thought through beforehand. "Is that why you let her go so easily?" she demands. "Did you think you were releasing her into the wild?"
"I told you what I was thinking," Park says. "I'm not in the habit of lying to you."
"Because this is not her natural fucking habitat," Justinu goes on. It feels like there's something bitter that she's swallowed, that she has to talk around. "She has no clue about this place, less than we do, and God knows we don't have much. She might be able to find food for herself, but that's not the same as surviving, Parks. She'd be living with animals, living like an animal, so an animal is what she'd be. The little girl would die. What would be left would be something a lot more like all the other Hungries out there."
"I let her loose so she could eat," Parks says. "I didn't think past that."
"Yeah, but you're not an idiot."
She's come right up close to him, and he's actually backed away a little, as far as he can in that narrow space. All she can see of his face in the torch's angled beam is the tight set of his mouth. Caroline can indulge in the luxury of not thinking. You can't.
"Thought the doc was meant to be a genius," Parks mutters with unconvincing nonchalance.
Same thing. She only sees what's at the bottom of her test tubes. When she calls Melanie test subject number one, she means it. But you know better.
If you took a kitten away from its mother, then dumped it back again and the mother bit its throat out because it didn't smell right, you'd know that was your fault. If you caught a bird and taught it to talk, and then it escaped and it starved to death because it didn't know how to feed itself, you'd be absolutely clear that was on you. Well, Melanie's not a cat, is she? Or a bird? She might have grown up into something like that if you'd left her where you found her. Something wild that didn't know itself and just did whatever it needed to do. But you dropped a net over her and brought her home. And now she's yours. You interfered. You took on a debt.
Park says nothing. Slowly, Justinu reaches behind her and draws the flare gun from where she hid it. She brings it out and lets him see it in her hand. She walks to the door of the engine room.
Helen, Park says.
She goes through the aft weapons store to the door. It's locked but unguarded. Caldwell is in the lab and Gallagher is in the crew quarters flicking through the old CDs like they were porn.
Helen.
She disengages the lock. It's the first time she's done it, but it's not hard to figure out how the mechanism works. She glances back at Parks, who's got his handgun out and pointed right at her. But only for a second. The hand falls to his side again, and he puffs out his cheeks in a sigh, like he's put down a heavy weight. Justinu opens the door and steps out. She puts her arm up over her head and pulls the trigger. The sound is like a firework going off, but more drawn out. The flare whistles and sighs to itself as it ascends into the utter blackness above her. There's no light, nothing to see. The pistol was a good few years old, after all. Pre-breakdown, like most of Parks's kit. It must be a dud. Then, it's like God turned on a light in the sky. A red light. From what she knows about God, that's the colour he'd favour. Everything is as clearly visible as in daylight. But this is nothing like daylight. It's the light of an abattoir, or a horror movie. And it must have reached the interior spaces of Rosie, even though someone has pulled the light-proof baffles down over the tiny reinforced windows, because now Gallagher is looking out through the door right next to Parks, and Caroline Caldwell has deigned to step out of the lab too, and is standing behind them, staring out in bewilderment at the crimson midnight.
You'd better get back inside, Parks tells Justinu in a voice of flat resignation. She won't be the only one that sees that.
Chapter 57. Melanie isn't lost, but the sight of the flare cheers her. She's sitting on the roof of a house half a mile away from Rosie. She's been sitting there for some hours now, in a steady downpour that's already soaked her to the skin. She's trying to make sense of something she saw late in the afternoon, just after she'd finally filled her belly. She's been running it through in her mind ever since in endless, silent replay. What she ate, after searching rain-slicked alleyways and sodden gardens for an hour and a half, was a feral cat. And she hated it. Not the cat itself, but the process of chasing and catching and eating it. The hunger was driving her, and driving her hard, telling her exactly what to do. As she ripped the cat's belly open with her teeth and gorged herself on what came tumbling out, a part of her was entirely satisfied. Entirely at peace. But there was another part that kept itself at a distance from the horrible cruelty and the horrible messiness. That part saw the cat still alive, still twitching as she crunched its fragile ribs to get at its heart, heard its piteous mewling as it clawed at her uselessly, opening shallow cuts in her arms that didn't even bleed, smelled the bitter stench of excrement as she accidentally tore open its entrails, and saw her strew the guts in the air like streamers to get at the soft flesh underneath. She ate it hollow. And as she did, she dodged through all kinds of irrelevant thoughts. The cat in the picture on the wall of her cell, peacefully and intently lapping up its milk. The proverb about all cats being black at night, which she didn't understand, and Mr. Whittaker couldn't explain.
a poem in a book. I love little Kitty, her coat is so warm, and if I don't hurt her, she'll do me no harm. She didn't love little Kitty all that much. Little Kitty didn't taste half as nice as the two men she ate back at the base. But she knew that little Kitty would keep her alive, and she hoped that the hunger would quiet down a little now and not try to order her around so much. Afterwards, she wandered the streets, feeling both miserable and agitated, unable to keep still. She kept coming back within sight of Rosalind Franklin to make sure it was still there, then veering off again into this or that side street and getting herself lost for an hour or so. She didn't want to go back yet. She was starting to feel as though she'd need to eat again before she did that. With each loop, she walked a little further and dragged her feet a little more. She was probing the edges of her hunger, exploring the feel and the urgency of it, in the way Sergeant Parks explored the rooms at Wainwright House with his rifle in his hands and his eyes going backwards and forwards. It was enemy territory, and she had to get to know it. On one of her outward swings, she found herself in front of a big white building with lots of windows. The windows on the ground floor were enormous, and all broken. There were more windows higher up that were still in their frames. The sign in front of the building said Arts Depot, a little Arts, and then a much bigger Depot, sitting right above the door. And the door used to be made of glass, so now it wasn't really there at all. It was just an empty frame, gripping a few fragments of broken glass at its very edges. There were noises coming from inside, shrill, short bursts of sound like the yelps of a hurt animal. A hurt animal would go down very nicely right around then, Melanie thought. She went inside, into a room with a very high ceiling and two staircases at the end of it. The staircases were metal, with rubbery bits for you to put your hands on. There was another sign at the bottom of them. The light was starting to fade now, and Melanie could only just read it. It said, "Children must be carried on the escalator." She walked up the stairs. They gave a metallic groan when she first put her weight on them, and shifted slightly with each step she took, as though they were about to fall down. She almost turned back, but those shrieks and squeals from inside the building were louder now, and she was curious as to what sort of creature was making them. At the top of the stairs there was a big room with pictures on the walls and lots of chairs and tables. The pictures were impossible to understand, containing words and pictures that seemed to bear no relationship to each other. One said, "Twisted Folk Autumn Tour," and showed a man playing a guitar. But then it showed the same man in the same position playing lots of other things. A dog, a chair, a tree, another man, and so on. Some of the tables had plates and cups and glasses on them, but the cups and glasses were all empty, and there was nothing on the plates except for indeterminate smears from food that had rotted away a long, long time ago, so that now even the rot was gone. Nothing seemed out of place up here, or alive for that matter. Melanie could hear the sounds of rapid movement now as well as the squealing, but the room was so big and so full of echoes that she couldn't tell which direction the sounds were coming from. She looked around. There were staircases and doors everywhere. She took another staircase at random, then a door, then she walked along a corridor and through two other doors that swung open at her touch. And stopped at once. The way you might stop when you suddenly saw that you'd got too close to the edge of a cliff. The space she was in now was much, much bigger than the room downstairs, big as that had seemed. It was completely dark, but she guessed its size from the change in the echoes and from the movement of the air in front of her face. She didn't even have to think about these things. She just knew this place was vast. And the sounds were coming from below her, so that vastness extended in three dimensions, not two. Melanie held her hands out in front of her at chest height and stepped forward, little baby steps that brought her very quickly to the edge of a platform. Under her fingers was the cold metal of a rail or balustrade. She stood silently, listening to the squeals, the pounding of feet,
and other rhythmical slaps and booms that came and went. Then someone laughed, a high, delighted trill. She stood rooted to the spot, amazed. She could feel that she was trembling. That laugh could have been made by Anne, or Zoe, or any of her friends in the class. It was a little girl's laugh, or just possibly a little boy's. She almost shouted out, but she didn't. It was a nice laugh, and she thought that perhaps the person who made it must be nice too. But it couldn't just be one person making all that noise. It sounded like lots and lots of people running around, playing a game, perhaps, in the dark. She waited for so long that something strange happened. She started to be able to see. There wasn't any more light to see by. It was just that her eyes decided to give her more information. She'd been told in a lesson once about something called accommodation. The rods and cones of the eye, especially the rods, change their zone of sensitivity so that they can see details and distinctions in what previously looked like total darkness. But there are functional limits to that process, and the resulting picture is mostly black and white, because rods aren't good at gradations of colour. This was different. It was like an invisible sun came up in the room, and Melanie could see by its light as well as she could see by day. Or like the space below her went from black ocean to dry land over the space of a few minutes. She wondered if this was something only Hungries could do. She was in a theatre. She'd never seen one before, but she knew that was what it had to be. There were rows and rows of seats all facing the same way, and where they were facing, there was a wide, flat place with a wooden floor. A stage. There were more seats on a balcony on top of the first lot of seats, and that was where Melanie was, at one end of the balcony, standing at the edge where it looked down into the main auditorium below. And she was right about there being more than one person down there. There were at least a dozen. They weren't playing a game, though. What they were doing was quite different. Melanie watched them in silence for a long time, perhaps as long as she'd listened to them, or a little more. Her eyes were wide, and her hands gripped very tight onto the balcony rail as though she was afraid of falling down. She watched until the noises and the movement died away. Then she slipped out, as quietly as she could, through the swing doors and down the stairs. Out on the street, where it was raining harder than ever, she walked a few faltering steps and came to a halt in the shadow of a wall whose ancient graffiti had faded to ghost patterns of black and grey. Something was happening to her face. Her eyes were burning, her throat convulsing. It was almost like the first breath you take in the shower room after the showers have been turned on and the air fills with bitter spray. But there was no spray here. She was just crying. The part of her mind that had stayed detached and watched her eat the cat watched this performance too, and mourned a little that, because of the rain, it was impossible to determine whether her weeping involved actual tears. Chapter 58. The night crawls past arthritically and aimlessly after a supper that, despite its perilously high salt and sugar content, nobody seems able to taste. Justinu sits in the crew quarters, twisted round in the seat so she can look through one of the slit windows at the street outside. Behind her, she can hear Gallagher's fitful snoring from the sleeping recess. He chose one of the top bunks and stole blankets from most of the others to make himself a nest. He's completely invisible up there, barricaded away from the world behind ramparts of dreams and polycotton. He's the only one who sleeps at all. Parks is still stripping the generator, and he doesn't seem inclined to stop. Intermittent clattering from back there tells Justinu that he's making progress. Intermittent swearing announces his temporary setbacks. In between them is the lab, where Caldwell works in silence, putting slide after slide under a Zeiss LSM-510 confocal microscope with its own built-in battery, The scanning electron microscope still awaits the quickening touch of electric current from Rosie's generator, writing annotations for each in a leather-backed notebook, then racking it in a plastic box whose compartments she carefully numbers. When the sun comes up, Justinu is silently amazed. It seemed entirely plausible that this ontological impasse would go on forever. Through the red dawn, a tiny figure walks out of a side street and crosses to Rosie's door. Justinu gives an involuntary cry and runs to open it. Parks is there ahead of her, and he doesn't move out of her way. There's a thin, muffled sound, bare knuckles, knocking politely on the armour plating.
"You're going to have to let me handle this," Parks tells her.
He's got shadows under his eyes and oil smudges on his forehead and cheeks. He looks like he just murdered someone who bled India ink. There's a weary, defeated set to his shoulders.
"What does handle it mean?" Justinu demands. "It just means I talk to her first."
"With a gun in your hand?"
"No," he grunts irritably. "With these."
He shows her his left hand, in which he holds the leash and the handcuffs. Justinu hesitates for a second.
"I know how handcuffs work," she says. "Why can't I be the one to go out to her?"
Parks wipes his dirty brow on his dirty sleeve.
"Jesus wept," he mutters under his breath. "Because that's what she asked for before she left, Helen. You're the one she's concerned about hurting, not me. I'm nearly certain she's okay because she just knocked on the door instead of clawing at it and bashing her head against it. But whatever kind of mood she's in, the one thing she won't want to see when she opens it is you standing there. Especially if she's got blood on her mouth or her clothes from feeding. You understand that, right? After she's cleaned herself up, and after she's got the cuffs back on, then you can talk to her. Okay?"
Justinu swallows. Her throat is dry. The truth is that she's afraid. Mostly, she's afraid of what the last 12 hours might have done to Melanie. Afraid that when she looks into the girl's eyes, she might see something new and alien there. For that very reason, she doesn't want to put the moment off. And she doesn't want Parks to look first. But she does understand, whether she wants to or not, and she can't go against what Melanie specifically asked for. She has to step back, and around the bulkhead wall, while he opens the door. She hears the bolt slide back, the smooth sigh of hydraulically assisted hinges. And then she flees, through the aft weapon stations to the lab space. Dr. Caldwell looks up at her, indifferent at first, until she realises what Justinu's agitation must mean.
"Melanie is back," the doctor says, coming to her feet.
"Good. I was concerned she might have..."
"Shut your mouth, Caroline,"
Justinu interrupts savagely.
"Seriously, shut it now and don't open it again."
Caldwell continues to stare at her. She makes to walk aft, but Justinu is in her way and she stays there. All that aggression that's building up in her, it's got to come out.
"Sit down," Justinu says. "You don't get to see her. You don't get to talk to her."
"Yeah, she does," says Parks from behind her. She turns and he's standing in the doorway. Melanie is behind him. He hasn't even put her cuffs on yet, but she's already replaced her muzzle. She's sodden, her hair plastered to the side of her head, her T-shirt clinging to her bony body. The rain has petered out now, so this is from last night.
"She wants to talk to all of us," Parks goes on, "and I think we want to listen. Tell them what you just told me, kid."
Melanie stares hard at Justinu, then even harder at Dr. Caldwell.
"We're not alone out here," she says. "There's somebody else."
Chapter 59. In the crew quarters, they choose places to sit. Even though Rosie's full complement was meant to be a dozen, it feels way too small. They're aware of each other's proximity, and none of them looks any more comfortable with that than Justinu feels.
She's sitting on the edge of a lower bunk. Caldwell sits on its counterpart directly opposite. Gallagher is cross-legged on the floor, and Parks leans in the doorway. Standing at the forward end of the narrow space, Melanie addresses them. Justinu has dried her hair with a towel, hung out her jacket, jeans and t-shirt to dry, and put another towel around her as a temporary bathrobe. Her arms are inside the towel, behind her back, because Parks has cuffed her hands again. It was her idea. She turned her back to him, arms held together, and waited patiently while he did it. There's massive tension in her face, in the way she stands. She's struggling to keep herself under control, not in the feeding frenzy way, but in the way someone might be if they'd just been mugged on the street or witnessed a murder. Justinu has seen Melanie scared before, but this is something new, and for a little while Justinu struggles to identify it. Then she realizes what it is. It's uncertainty. She speculates for the first time on what Melanie could have seen, could have become, if she'd lived before the breakdown. If she'd never been bitten and infected. Because this is a child here, whatever else she is. And she's never lost that sense of her own centre before, except when she smelled blood and turned, briefly, into an animal. And look how pragmatically, how ruthlessly she's coped with that. But Justinu only pursues this train of thought for a moment. When Melanie starts to speak, she commands their full attention. "I should have come back sooner," she says to everyone in the room. "But I was scared, so I ran away and hid at first."
"They don't need a dramatic build-up, kid." Parks drops into the ensuing silence. "Just go ahead and tell them."
But Melanie starts at the beginning and rolls right on, as though that's the only way she knows how to tell it. She recounts her visit to the theatre the night before in spare and functional sentences. The only sign of her agitation is in the way she shifts from foot to foot as she speaks. Finally, she reaches the point where she looked down from the balcony with her dark adapted eyes and saw what was below her. "They were men like the ones I saw at the base," she says, "with shiny black stuff all over them and their hair all spiked up. In fact, I think they were exactly the same ones from the base." Justinu feels her stomach lurch. Junkers are maybe the worst news they could get right now. "There were lots and lots of them. They were fighting each other with sticks and knives, except that they weren't. Not really. They were only pretending to fight. And they had guns, too, like yours, in big racks on the walls. But they weren't using them. They were just using the sticks and the knives. First knives, then sticks, then knives again. The man who was in charge of the fighting told them when to use sticks and when to change over. And someone asked when they could stop, and he said, 'Not until I say so.'" Melanie shoots a glance at Caroline Caldwell. Her expression is unreadable.
"Did you get an idea how many there were?" Parks asks.
"I tried to count, Sergeant Parks, and I got to 55. But there could have been more, underneath where I was standing. There was a part of the room that I couldn't see, and I didn't want to move in case they heard me. I think there were probably more."
"Jesus,"
Gallagher says. His voice is hollow with despair.
"I knew it. I knew they wouldn't stop."
"What made you think," Caldwell asks, "that this was the same group who attacked the base?" "I recognised some of them," Melanie says promptly. "Not their faces, really, but the clothes they wore. Some of them had patches and bits of metal on them, and they made patterns. I remembered the patterns. And one of them had a word on his arm. Relentless."
"A tattoo," Parks translates.
"I think so," Melanie says, her eyes on Dr. Caldwell again. "And then, while I was watching, three more men came in. They talked about a trail that they were following, and they said they'd lost it. The leader got really angry with them and sent them straight back out again.
He said if they didn't bring back prisoners, he was going to let the other men use them to practice on with their knives and sticks. That seems to be the end of the story, but Melanie waits, tense and expectant, in case there are questions. "Christ almighty," Gallagher moans. He buries his head in his folded arms and keeps it there. Justinu turns to Parks. "What do we do?" she asks him. Because like it or not, he's the one who's going to formulate their strategy. He's the only one who really has a chance of bringing them out of here, now that they've run out of E-blocker, and there's an army of murderous lunatics camped on their doorstep. She's heard stories about what the Junkers do to people they take alive. Probably bullshit, but enough that you'd want to make sure they took you dead. "What do we do?" Gallagher echoes, unfolding from his crouch. He stares at her like she's crazy. "When we get out of here, we run. Now."
"Not yet, we don't," Park says deliberately.
And then when they turn to him,
"Better to roll than to run. I'm maybe an hour away from getting the generator working. And from where I stand, this bucket still gives us our best chance. So we don't make a break for it. We lock down until we're good and ready."
"It's anomalous behaviour," Caldwell muses. Parks gives her a shrewd glance.
"From the Junkers? Yeah, it is.
They were in convoy when we saw them, using the base's vehicles to cover the ground fast. Switching to a fixed base, a command post of some kind, makes no sense. A group that size is going to find it hard to live off the land. Scavenging has proved difficult enough even for the four of us." Justinu can just about find room to be surprised.
"Wow,"
she says, shaking her head. "Why don't you go and tell them that, Caroline? They nearly made a really stupid mistake there. They need someone with your wisdom and foresight to smack their heads together and get them thinking straight." Caldwell ignores this sally. "I think we may be missing something that would make sense of this," she says, forensically precise. "It doesn't make sense as it stands." Parks comes away from the doorframe, rubbing his shoulder.
"We lock down," he says again. "Nobody goes out there until further notice. Private, did you find any duct tape in those lockers?"
Gallagher nods. "Yes, sir. 3 full rolls. 1 started."
"Tape up the windows. No telling how good those flare baffles are."
When he mentions flares, Justinu feels a rush of shame and retrospective dread. When she fired that flare last night, she could have brought the Junkers right down on their heads. Parks should have shot her when he had the chance.
"And check how we're doing for water," he's saying now. "Doc, you were going to see if there was any in the filtration tank."
"The tank is full," Caldwell says, "but I wouldn't advise drinking from it until the generator is running. There's algae in there, and probably a lot more contaminants besides. We can rely on the filters to do their job, but only once they get some power."
"Then I guess I'd better get back to work," Park says.
But he doesn't leave. He's looking at Melanie.
"What about you?" he demands. "Are you holding up? Been most of a day now since any of us put any blocker on."
"I'm fine now," Melanie tells him in the same pragmatic tone, as though they were discussing some problem external to both of them. "But I can smell all 4 of you. Miss Justinu and Kieran a little, you and Dr. Caldwell a lot. If I can't go out to hunt again, you'd better find some way to lock me up." Gallagher looks up quickly when Melanie says she can smell him, but he doesn't say anything. He's looking a little pale around the gills.
"Handcuffs and a muzzle aren't enough," Parks asks.
"I think I could pull my hands out of the handcuffs, if I had to," Melanie tells him. "It would hurt, because I would scrape the skin all off, but I could do it. And then it would be very easy to get the muzzle off." "There's a specimen cage in the lab," Dr. Caldwell says. "I believe it's big enough, and strong enough."
"No!"
Justinu spits out the word.
The anger that went to sleep while Melanie was talking yawns and stretches, awake again in an instant.
Sounds like a good idea, Park says. Get it ready, Doc. Kid, stay close to it, like a hop and a jump away. And if you feel anything...
That's absurd, says Caldwell. You can't expect her to self-monitor.
Any more than we can expect you to, Justinu says. You've been itching to get your hands on her ever since we left the base.
Since before that, Caldwell says. But I've resigned myself to waiting until we reach Beacon. Once we're there, the Survivors' Council can hear us both out and make a determination.
Justinu is two syllables into an obscene rejoinder when Parks claps his hand down on her shoulder and turns her round to face him. The brusqueness of it takes her by surprise. He's almost never touched her, and never since his abortive pass on the roof of Wainwright House.
Enough, he says. I need you in the engine room, Helen. The rest of you, you know what you're doing, or you should do. The kid goes in the cage, but you don't touch her, Doc. For now, she's off limits. You cut her, you'll answer to me. Trust me. All those slides you spent last night making up will not survive the encounter. Understood?
I've said I'll wait.
And I believe you. I'm just saying. Helen?
Justinu lingers for a moment longer. If she comes near you, she says to Melanie, just scream and I'll be right there. She follows Parks all the way aft to the engine room, where he closes the door and leans his weight against it.
I know things are bad, Justinu says. I'm not trying to make them worse. I don't trust her. I can't.
No, Parks agrees. I don't blame you. But nothing's going to happen to the kid. You've got my word.
It's a relief to hear him say that. To know that he recognises Melanie as an ally, at least for now, and won't let her be hurt.
But I'd like you to do me a favour in return, Parks goes on.
Justinu shrugs.
Okay, if I can.
What? Find out what she really saw.
What?
Justinu is mystified for a moment. Not angry or exasperated, just at a loss to understand what Parks is saying.
Why would she lie? Why would you even think that she... Shit! Because of what Caroline said. Because she fancies herself as an anthropologist. She doesn't know shit. You can't expect psychopaths like the Junkers to make rational decisions.
Probably not, Parks agrees.
Then what are you talking about?
Helen, the kid's talking hairy-arsed nonsense. I'm pretty sure she saw something last night, and it was probably something that scared her, because she's really sincere about wanting us to leave. But it wasn't Junkers.
Justinu is getting angry again.
Why? She demands. How do you know? And how many times does she have to prove herself to you?
None. No times. I think I've got a pretty good handle on her now. But her story doesn't hold together at all.
He picks up one of the manuals he's been working from, which he's left lying on the cowling of the generator, and sets it aside so he can sit there. He doesn't look happy.
I can see why you wouldn't want to face up to this, Justinu says. If they followed us from the base, it means we screwed up. We left a trail.
Parks gives a sound that could be a laugh or just a snort.
We left a trail you could follow facing backwards with your head in a bucket, he says. It's not that, it's just...
He raises a hand and starts counting off on his fingers.
She says she saw all men, no women, which means this is a temporary camp. So why don't they put up a perimeter? How come she can walk right in there and walk right out again without being seen?
Maybe they have lousy security, Parks. Not everyone has your skill set.
Maybe.
And then we have those guys conveniently coming in just at the right moment and saying they're following someone. And the tattoo. Private Barlow, back at the base. He had that same word on his arm. some coincidence.
Coincidences happen, Parks.
Sometimes they do, Parks agrees. But then there's Rosie.